right. So, Columbia. What research paths did you embark on there?
Well, it was a very awkward time at Columbia. Immediately as I got there, there was oil crisis, waiting lines, recession, all kinds of things happened. I remember the office I was in was cold most of the time because they were cutting back on the heat. Many of the commitments they made seemed to evaporate. I was in a state bureaucracy that's far more difficult than any federal bureaucracy I was dealing with. And people were doing things that I just didn't recall in Chicago. In Chicago, I actually was off campus. I had my own offices and things, we were running things. And Columbia, basically, people were fighting over tiny little offices. Who's going to get that office? Who's going to get that space? And things of this sort. And it seemed to me that the contrast between doing something, on a broad scale that had importance and fighting over an office was just something that I found difficult to deal with. So the transition I found very difficult, and it was made far more difficult by the difficulties of, moving again, finding a house, and at the same time, the Watergate was heating up and there were all kinds of things, and people for whom I had some respect. I mean, John Ehrlichman was a liberal in that Nixon White House, and I knew Crowe reasonably well. And some of these people, were doing, I think, what they thought you're supposed to do when you work for a president. And I thought there's a certain, everybody was sort of gloating about this because they didn't like Nixon, but I felt that whatever you felt about Nixon, these guys were carrying out what they thought was legitimate function, and there was something unjust about it. So I felt kind of bad, but I also had the task from 73 to, I had 1 year to get out Goodman and Gilman. That kept me busy. And, there were lots of people there who felt that they should have gotten the job that I got. And so there were a variety of difficult issues. And the other thing I wanted to do is I did want to get involved with more into smoking. I was kind of doing penance for focusing so much on heroin, which, was visible but affected a very small population. Tobacco had been largely ignored, and it affected millions. And I didn't think there had been quite enough attention to the addictiveness of tobacco. As you can see, even in 1970, G&G was not quite accepted. It certainly wasn't a diagnosis. You couldn't talk about it. So I immediately got involved in that and couldn't really drum up much enthusiasm for it, at least for a while. And so I got involved in trying to understand how effective treatment was, trying to learn more about it, because I really never really plunged into it in depth. Doing the G&G, trying to do some other things as well. We did some very interesting studies on a drug that everybody uses now. We did the initial assessments of the abuse potential of loperamide. Imodium. Mm-hmm. Everybody uses it now. It's over the counter.
Yeah, and it's got a little, in it? An opiate, doesn't it?
It is an opiate. Except it's a peripheral opiate. It just doesn't get absorbed, and it's totally insoluble. So it's not a drug that has very much abuse potential.
So it's a sort of Schedule 5?
The only thing it does is give you constipation.
Yeah.
No, it's not even in Schedule 5 anymore. Start off at Schedule 5. And then it was dropped.
Yeah.
And we did that study. But the focus, I think, for me was on the tobacco, but getting people used to doing things other than the strict psychiatric stuff.
So and you were in a department of psychiatry?
It was called the Department of Biological Psychiatry.
Yeah, okay.
It was within the Psychiatric Institute, which was a state institute for the study of psychiatry.
Yes. And did you have a lab?
Well, I did, but I didn't. I mean, they said, this is your space, but the guy who was in it was saying, this is my space, and he was a civil servant. You know, it was the kind of thing where I couldn't get invested in the infighting. It just, at that stage of my life, just didn't feel like the stakes were big enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how did you get the project to develop diagnostic criteria for tobacco dependence?
Oh, Bob Spitzer and I did that. I convinced him that tobacco had to be in. He said, if tobacco, and I was working on this because we had already published by 75, I guess, on smoke enders and other things. We were doing things of that sort. So he and I discussed it, and we decided there would be criteria. And they're right there in DSM-3. That's the draft of DSM-3 before it was actually released in 78. And there's a whole issue of whether, how can you create a disorder that will, you know, if it's a psychiatric disorder or substance abuse, does that really say that 50 million people have a psychiatric disorder that they didn't have yesterday?
How do you reply to that question?
Well, you know, awkwardly. I wrote a paper called Tobacco Use and Tobacco Use Disorder. You know, that you can use it, but you're really not dependent unless you want treatment. Then
so
you
again,
are.
The continuum idea.
Well, obviously everything on a continuum, but I mean, even people who are regular smokers, do they have it if they say they could stop any time and they don't want to stop? I mean, there are some awkward kinds of things about this. And so I wrote a couple of papers on that. You know, at the, you know, eventually it sorted itself out. Not entirely satisfactory, if you ask me, but it did. But I felt some satisfaction. At least we got it in for the first time into DSM-3. It was a diagnosis, and we defended it against many attacks from people from Bowman Gray and places of that sort. Who obviously, since it was started by, you know, the major funding of the medical schools came from the tobacco industries, they might have had some interest, but they might have been smokers and just didn't like the idea of being called drug dependent. At any rate, so that went on, and I was going to do some other things. I got into a dead end, a real major mistake. I think I was, you know, like most of the public, I was misled, you know, by the tobacco company advertisement, and I didn't think it through enough. Maybe I was sort of naive, but there was a paper written by a guy named Gio Gori that looked at, you know, if you assume that we're talking about a dose-response relationship for the toxicity. If the average cigarette contains 15 milligrams of tar and you reduce the tar to 1, you know, what's the implication of that? And he published some stuff, you know, in terms of the dose-response relationship with tobacco and lung cancer, and concluded that at a certain level, 2 or 3 cigarettes a day, there was no statistical increase. But he said, you know, you don't have to get there by using 2 or 3 cigarettes a day. What would happen, because 2 or 3 cigarettes a day of the regular cigarettes are 45 milligrams of tar. Suppose you smoked 15 cigarettes of 1 milligram of tar. That's even less. Now, that seemed logical, except that I just didn't understand and was kind of, I guess it was naive, about exactly how it was measured, you know. That they're really not measuring what a smoker takes in, they're measuring what the machine takes in. I knew that, but I tried to go through what the calculations were, and I didn't get it right. And I assumed that, yeah, there is something here. And so I said, the problem is, why isn't everybody switching over? They have light, they have very light, they have ultralight. What does it take to get people to switch over? It's like, could I get everybody onto methadone was the equivalent. Mm-hmm. What is the motivation? And so we started with something with economic incentives. If I paid people, would they switch? That was a blind alley. We got people to switch, but it was only later that we realized how the capacity of people to compensate in various ways for the lowered tar and nicotine levels, because essentially, and this was the discovery, the tobacco in the cigarettes was the same. There was no difference in the tobacco. What they were doing was making little holes in the filter. So when the cigarette machine smoked it, they would dilute all that with air, and so the tar and the nicotine would go down. And the cigarette machine would always smoke it in the exact same way. It was a 2-second puff. There was an interval of maybe 30 seconds. Everything was the same. But a person doesn't do that. A person can immediately sense the amount of nicotine they're taking in and take a deeper puff. And then what we missed out on as well, they could take a slightly deeper puff, they could smoke more cigarettes a day, but we don't see them smoking more cigarettes a day. What we didn't realize is that how things change when you take, let's say, a 45-second puff instead of a 30-second puff, or a deeper puff, and what happens when you hold it just a few seconds longer, dwell time. In other words, all you have to do is just a little bit longer and you can double the amount you absorb. And so it turns out that they found much later that as people smoke these ultra-low things, the degree to which the smoker is exposed to less tar and nicotine is not as great as the difference, let's say, between 10 milligrams of, was it 10 or so, 1 milligram of nicotine and a tenth of a milligram of nicotine. It looks like a huge amount, or 15 milligrams of tar and 2 milligrams of tar. It's not that big because of the change in the behavior of the smoker. Didn't realize that then. And so we spent a lot of time trying to get people to switch. Actually, in our study, which we never got around to publishing for a variety of reasons, we actually saw that people did cut down, that their nicotine levels did drop in their blood. But the other thing that began to emerge as you got into it is that the dose response curves are not the same for lung cancer and cardiovascular disease. So maybe even a cigarette or two can give you heart disease, even if it doesn't give you lung cancer. So, you know, the idea that you can cut down and do something safely probably was not a great idea. And so, you know, I was, in one sense, sort of a victim of the tobacco companies. They never really said that this will cut down, but clearly that was the implication of this. And it took a while to discover that tobacco was the same. It's very, very costly to do your own analyses. It costs $20,000 to go through a battery of these things to find out what the cigarette is really producing. I mean, all you can do is accept what they show. So, it was just not a good feeling about the place. It was probably my fault having to do more with, you know, the change from Washington to back into that academic setting. But it may have been that I never really understood academia in New York. Mm-hmm. And I did know that at Einstein, you know, all the space belonged to somebody, even the janitors, but I just didn't know. And then there was a new chairman came in. I was recruited by Larry Culp Jr. Lovely, lovely man. And then there was a new guy who wanted lots of changes. And it was okay. But it just didn't feel right. And then Roger Meyer, who was an old friend, all the way back to 66, and who'd been a consultant with me at Sayadap, asked me if I'd be interested in coming up there, and he had a new alcohol center. And I just felt, you know, I think interpersonal relationships are important. I just wanted to feel more comfortable, and I went up to Connecticut. I don't think I accomplished much in New York. Probably mostly my fault. And it may very well be that, you know, it was an inopportune time to come and be involved in writing Goodman and Gilman when I should have been building and getting grants and things of this sort. But it was awkward trying to get grants because these were all people that I had funded, and there was this a kind of, I guess it was an ambiguity about whether somebody who had held my position could actually get money from the federal government for the first year.
There was.
I don't know what it was. I mean, you couldn't get, there was nobody to get definitive answers for you. You have to understand this was early 1974. Mm-hmm. Things were falling apart.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there was really no way to really figure this out. I just didn't want to apply and have people give me a runaround. So that's where things were.
And so your move to University of Connecticut,
yeah.
Did you intend then to do alcohol research?
No, there was an alcohol center. I was interested in alcohol and tobacco. Heroin turned out to be difficult to work with because, as you point out, everybody staked out the turf in New York. Now, actually, I did some work with a friend named Ron Brady. We looked at a drug that they're looking at again to see if it's suppressed withdrawal. I developed some techniques for looking at outpatient things. But in general, everybody had a program. Everybody knew everything that was going on, and there was a certain sense of, we know how to do it. And I might have just been that I was not in a particularly combative mood. So Roger had the grant. I went up there. I tried to make certain that they would, that the insurance companies and places like that where I could do the tobacco research. And I did recruit some people to come up and do that. We did a little bit. But mostly I worked on the alcohol stuff. And it was an interesting kind of years, and the relationships were good. But Faith never wanted to move because she felt the kids had moved enough. Moved on a number of times, and it was time for them to finish high school. And it was kind of a strain going back and forth between Westchester and Hartford. And the other thing is, so when Bill Pollan asked me to come down to head the ARC, given that that's where I had headed, the day I left medical school, I said, no, I really don't want to do it because, again, it's a salary cut. I was doing very well. And he was kind of persuasive, and I said, you should get Chuck O'Brien, get this one, get that one. Well, nobody wanted to take that kind of salary cut. I mean, the salaries were about $30,000 or $40,000 less than I was making. But I said, the ARC has a certain, there's a certain kind of appeal for me. And so I went down there and I put in some time and we did some studies.
So let me ask you about the ARC at that time.
Yeah.
Did you feel that by then the ARC had changed?
Sure it changed. It was trying to reconstitute itself. I mean, it had just moved. This was, into a new building. It had just made the transition. It was working just a little bit in a one floor of a building with volunteers. Still doing abuse potential stuff, but not the stuff that an intramural program ought to do.
So would it be fair to characterize the abuse potential stuff as somewhat routine or pedestrian by then?
I don't want you to put words in.
No,
mouth,
I don't want to.
I guess if I were selecting those words, I couldn't. I wouldn't say I hadn't already thought that. Yes, that's probably fair.
Okay.
That, it did not, just doing abuse potential was not what a real intramural program was set up to do. It ought to be more cutting edge. It ought to be more definitive. It's not that it didn't have some value, but that could not be the major focus. And I spoke to some people like Avram Goldstein and other things. They said, you should be basically getting into molecular and genetic things. Well, these things I didn't know about. But that's where the cutting edge was. I mean, after all, this was 1984. We'd known about receptors now for almost 14 years. People were talking about more than the receptors, the intracellular changes produced. So there's a whole world of going on in terms of understanding drug actions. And so the idea was, you know, how do you take what is essentially sort of a stable budget, which is very unusual in the research field, and make it so that you deserve it, because otherwise, why shouldn't you be competing like the extramural people do? And there, so there had to be a connection between what they were doing in the lab and what they were doing in the intramural clinical program and in the, if you had an outpatient treatment program, I mean, why not do some kinds of definitive studies in terms of treatment? Because now they had all that facility again. They were just moving into it in 84. And so the issue is one of, you know, how do you recruit people? How do you make it attractive to people? The salaries were not as good as the salaries in academia, and certainly the constraints were greater. So the problem really was one of how do you move, what's that phase, that transition issue? And frankly, you know, I might not have been the best person to lead it. I didn't have, you know, the kinds of research technologies that would allow me to personally set up a molecular lab or an imaging lab or a lab looking at receptors and things of this sort. I knew that that was important stuff and it ought to be done. I'm going to link that with the clinical things. But my interest by that time had become more or less clinical. I guess it's easier to stay on top of clinical designs.
So, but you were also, you were faced with helping to get that clinical research program. I mean, Jasinski, they had gotten a clinical research program up and going, but you were, what was your role, I guess, in formalizing that or institutionalizing
it? They weren't doing much, they weren't doing real treatment outcome research. They weren't taking the products of what they were doing and testing to see if they would have relevance to the field. They were sort of letting other people do that. And Lexington never did any treatment outcome stuff because they couldn't. It was strictly intramural, strictly. They had the opportunity, since they were recruiting people from the community, why not see how well they did in the community with things of that sort?
Were they receptive to that idea?
It was not easy. You had to find people who were interested. You had to recruit people. You know, Don continued to do the work that he was interested in doing. Other people continued to do the work that they were interested in doing. The guys who were doing the monkey work, Steve Goldberg and his people, continued to do that. There were some people who were doing some things that I felt were very unproductive, and I asked them to change.
And what kinds of things were those?
Not well, they were working on the spinal dog, for example. And I just thought, you know, cutting the spinal cords of beagle dogs was unnecessarily cruel.
Why were they working on spinal dogs?
Because that's what Bill Martin had taught them to do.
Yes.
That's the model they knew to work on.
Why was it? Was it a good model?
It was a good model if you could come up with some question. If you were innovative, if you had ideas that looked like they would lead someplace, but doing the same thing again and again didn't seem to make a lot of sense. You know, Tony Yaksh at California has done wonderful work looking at spinal actions of opiates, but that's not what people were doing. So we had this very expensive maintenance and ethical issue about the dogs, and you know, so we asked them to try to switch gears and do some other things.
And did you discuss that as an ethical issue with them?
Oh, I don't think it had to be discussed. We were all very well aware of people's attitudes toward using animals in any way, let alone animals that you would disable in that way. I mean, this was the time where people were talking about the what was called the Silver Spring monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
Joe Brady was fighting that fight. I mean, that was good research, and he fought that fight. Well, we had monkeys. And the monkeys were self-administering things and doing things. That was worth defending, but I'm not sure that the dogs were. So there were some things at the animal level that shifted a little bit. But, you know, all in all, you know, we did recruit a couple of very, very able people in Mike Kuhar and George Yule, who are now very prominent people.
Yes.
And Mike brought some people with him, Earl D'Souza, people of that kind have gone on to, you know, do very well developing things, the pharmaceutical industry. So Edie London was already there and was doing great things. And I got a little bit involved in talking to her about you know, research design and things of that sort. So that might have been useful to her, I don't know. And we were looking at, you know, things like the sigma receptor. I mean, there were a number of people doing different things. And, you know, it and that kept me busy. But within about, oh, what was it? I was there for maybe less than a year. And then there was a change in leadership at NIDA. And Ian McDonald headed, I guess, ADMHA, and asked me to come down and be acting director of NIDA. So I had then two jobs again. I was running back and forth between Baltimore and Park Lawn Building, I guess. Was it Park Lawn? I guess it was the Park Lawn Building. Trying to run both of those things. It was, traffic wasn't quite as heavy, but it was pretty bad. And it was difficult. And I didn't want to run NIDA again. And finally, they got Bob Schuster to come in.
So you did that out of a sense of obligation, your interim acting director stint?
Yeah.
You didn't see it as an opportunity to...
To what?
To change the research priorities of NIDA, or...
No, I mean, I really did not. I did not want that visibility again. I did not want to be testifying before Congress again. I did not want all the... I mean, it's a place where, you know, one... To misspeak once or to be misinterpreted, you know, gotcha. You know. And, you know, you just don't want to do that, because one of the problems is the worst thing they can do to a to an individual is they can ask them to resign, but they can also punish the agency. So you have an obligation to everybody who's getting a grant to try to make sure that your agency is not seen as one that's not being supportive of the administration so they don't cut the budget. And, you know, I knew that, you know, it is a strange role to be involved with drugs in this country, given the different views of what should be done. I guess Ethan Nadelman was talking about that. This is going on for almost 20 years now. And what do you think of marijuana? You know, or it's certainly not going to be posed in that way. It will be posed in such a way that you can't possibly answer it without creating a headline for the reporter.
Yes. So I want to go back to the ARC for just a moment.
Yeah.
You talked a bit about animal ethical issues, but my understanding was that there was some kind of clinical ethical issues that also were problematic for you, and I don't remember where I read that, but were there clinical studies that were being done that you didn't want to be done in the way that they were being done?
Well, yeah, there were some.
And do you remember any of that detail?
Well, there, you know, I think that there were some studies. You know, it wasn't that they weren't ethical, is that the people who were doing them were not being, I don't think they were being quite as meticulous as they should have been, number one. It was not an ethical issue, except in one instance where they actually subjected somebody to a procedure more than once to please somebody else. I mean, without asking my permission or without going beyond the protocol. But occasionally they would make proposals to give doses of drugs that I didn't agree with, which is too risky. And there were a variety of things, sort of, I mean, there were always issues of, is this safe? Is this worth doing? Should we be doing this? And there, you know, the researchers are always eager to get on with it. Even if I was busy, I'd have to read, you know, if I would leave their protocol too long, they would complain. If I gave only attention to that, other things would fall by the wayside. So there were issues. Clearly, there were problems with how do you get proper coverage. I mean, once you have people living in a place participating, there are all kinds of responsibilities that are a problem. I don't think that was the main set of problems, however, that we dealt with. I don't think it was an issue so much of the ethics of things. I think we tried to. I mean, we didn't deviate from what people were doing in the past to that degree. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were still people around who said you shouldn't give drugs to addicts. But if we'd accepted that, then you'd close the whole thing down, because that's essentially what was being done. There were some studies where we didn't give drugs to addicts. I mean, we looked at cocaine withdrawal. And we did a buprenorphine study that was time-consuming that I think led to the... they were the pivotal studies that made buprenorphine an approved drug. And we did that against, I think, the resistance of the drug company that was concerned that, you know, it would cut into the sales of the analgesic as it became identified with the treatment of addiction. But they finally gave us the material and we did the study. People worked hard on those things.
Did you have to work with John Lewis, or how did you...
No, I think John Lewis had only invented it.
Mm-hmm.
He synthesized it. But the drug was in the hands. Maybe John Lewis had a role in it still, but I think we were working with Charles O'Keefe, getting supplies of it. I mean, the supplies we needed were not that extensive. I mean, we're not talking about a lot of drug when you only need 4 milligrams a day. And admittedly, it's expensive to produce at that time. But nevertheless, they gave us what we needed and we did the study. Edie London did some things, Mike Kuhar did some things. Some good things came out at the time. And, of course, there were some pedestrian things that came out, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a great interview with Mike Kuhar, very, very thorough in terms of explaining, you know, receptor fever, as he called it, and what he was able to do at that time. So, when Bob took over the reins, was that the point at which you went over to OTI?
No, he took over the reins. I guess I was only acting director for about a year, so that would make it maybe about either 85 or 86, and I didn't leave until 1990.
Ah, so what did you do the rest of the time?
Rest of the time where?
At NIDA.
Now, I stayed at the ARC until about 1990.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, so you stayed on as director of
the
ARC.
I went back to the, yeah.
You stopped working.
Yes.
Yes,
yeah.
Okay. All right. And then how did you come to go to OTI?
Well, I stopped being director of the ARC at Bob's request, so he could put in, what's-his-face from Nod, Virginia. Name will come to me shortly. And I went to NIDA for a few months, and then Benny Prim started OTI and asked me to come and work with him. Well, I'd worked with Benny, as you know, when I was at SEADAP, and Benny asked me to come and help get it started. It sounded like a reasonable thing. It was more in the area of treatment, and that's what I did. I can remember his wife's name, Daisy Ficus.
Oh, Roy Dickens.
Yeah.
Roy, yes. Yeah.
So Roy took over. And Roy lasted, I guess, about a year or two. And then George Yule was acting director for a while. And then they finally got somebody else. Anyway, and then I spent more time at OTI than I should have, I guess. It became an issue of inertia. Now, I was just maybe just too lazy to go find something else. And by 1997 or so, I just said, I think I'm going to stop. Had enough of government. And Paul Perito, who I just spoke to on the phone, asked me to consult with a company that had found a way to produce a low nitrosamine tobacco. And I had, from time to time before I left, you know, had dinner and gave them some free advice on smoking and smoking cessation and, you know, the role of, you know, what you could do with nicotine products in that. And, you know, just because Paul's my friend, I would tell people things that, you know, you don't always charge for giving advice, but, and free advice is, after all, worth what you pay for it. So, you know, we talked about it, and then this guy finally announced that he has found a way to produce tobacco with low nitrosamines. He was going to patent. That's a major technological breakthrough. He was going to start a company and do this and do that. He was going to fund research. And, you know, they said, would you help us fund good research? And I agreed to do that. And so for, I guess it was 3 or 4 years, I tried to get some research going for them. And we actually did some research. You know, but I don't think they really fully understood what the commitment to research meant in terms of publishing things and getting it done. I mean, they would fund it enough to get the results that they wanted to see, but they didn't want to fund it enough to get it published. And it looked as if they were basically doing things that the resources for research always came last on their list. And at some point, they weren't even paying the researchers that they committed to pay. And I couldn't negotiate to get research done for them if they weren't going to pay the people, because it made me look as if I was not being candid and I was responsible for the non-payment or something. So I decided I had enough of that too. And I guess that was 3 or 4 years ago.
Well, so when you were at OTI and CSAT, yes. Right?
Oh, we did a lot of things at OTI and CSAT.
You got, finally, in some ways, I mean, you got to do that sort of research that is about what works best for whom, that you had always been committed to.
Yeah, well, but you don't understand it. At CSAT, there was a conflict between NIDA and CSAT, and the way it resolved, you know, much to my distress in some ways, that CSAT wasn't allowed to do anything that had a control group.
That's how they put it?
Yes. You can't do research. You can give out money, but you can't have a control group. You can't do anything that has a control. We do the research. You just give out money for demonstrations. And, you know, in one sense, you had to say, you know, what good's a demonstration if you don't know whether it was effective? And how do you know if it's effective if you don't have a control group?
Yeah, so I see that time as a time when the research side separates from the treatment side, and treatment becomes service delivery and not research. Is that accurate?
That's correct. I mean, basically, within a year or so after OTI was formed, it, you know, NIMH, I mean, Adam Haas split up, NIDA went over to NIH. This thing became part of, what was it? What was the fancy? SAMHSA.
SAMHSA, yeah.
Yeah. And that was the big fight. I wasn't the fighter, but we were told you couldn't do this, you couldn't have that. We did it anyway. I mean,
so how did you do it?
Well, we did. Well, you basically, you could have short treatment and longer treatment. If you couldn't show any difference between 2 weeks and 8 weeks, maybe you weren't showing any difference at all. So, I mean, we did some things. We did the first studies on marijuana treatment. They are the ones that are still in the literature. Because, for the most part, the R1 is a terrific thing, but if nobody out there says, I think we should do some treatment of marijuana dependence, then you never have anything. You don't know whether anything
works. Explain
what
an R1 is.
R1 is when an investigator says, I propose to do this research. That's when you fund that, it's competitive, it's reviewed, and you give out the money, and he gets a grant. But you can't go and say, we're putting out a request for proposal, and we're going to write this kind of cooperative agreement or contract if you'll do this research. In other words, they didn't think the bureaucracy should be initiating the idea. But, you know, there was a time where nobody was doing any research on methamphetamine. The lag time is a couple of years, and so we funded, Walter Ling and Rick Rawson in California to do the first methamphetamine research, and we funded the cannabis research. We did a lot of other things too, but you know, in the nature of giving out demonstration grants, the scientific competence is not always the primary consideration. There has to be consideration of giving the money to different areas and different constituencies. But to the extent that within the limits of what could be done, I think we did a few things that left some mark on things. Benny had already started this $50 million thing with target cities by the time I got there, but we tried to shape it in such a way that maybe we would learn something. I don't think we learned much.
No.
We probably funded a lot of service.
Yes.
But what we were trying to do in the process of funding the service was funding the sort of the technological infrastructure for service. We were trying to say to people, you ought to know how many people are getting treated in your community. There ought to be some crosstalk between, there ought to be somebody looking over it, like Baltimore has, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 programs. Well, who knows what they're doing? Are they duplicating each other? Are there major gaps? You know, is everybody fully occupied, or some of them just getting funded, not seeing it? They're major questions.
Mm-hmm.
And we tried to frame it in a way that everybody would have a kind of an ethos, trying to say, given the idea of the Office of Treatment Improvement, the way you improve is to see, you know, who has the magic? Who gets people better? I mean, if you can't always do random assignment studies, but you can say, these guys get a much better outcome for the same kinds of patients. What are they doing? And when you identify what you think is the active ingredient in doing better, it's your job to try to communicate that to the people who aren't doing so well. And if some people who aren't doing so well don't really get the idea and they're still getting bad results, don't you have an ethical responsibility to say, why don't you find other work to do? I mean, you know, this is not done in American medicine except maybe through the tort laws. You know, there's a hospital that has, you know, a 10% mortality and the same procedure has a 1% mortality in another hospital if they're the same people. At some point, somebody has to tell the hospital that has the high mortality to either stop, change who does it, do something. But you just can't keep that up. Ultimately, there ought to be something better than tort laws. And they're really, in the field of addiction, that doesn't do much because it's so hard to know when somebody should have recovered and when they don't. But certainly people in larger communities like Baltimore or Philadelphia or Chicago ought to say, you know, we do spend a lot of money on this. Who's looking over to see, are they all good quality programs? Mm-hmm. And that's what Target Cities was about. And so, you know, getting, but training the staff to go out and to be able to deal with those concepts, and then getting people in the cities to try to understand how to get that done. It's tough. It's a lot tougher than just giving money and say, get the program started. I mean, that's all SEADAP did. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was not enough time to say, get started, because we're going to be back in 3 years to look and see how well you're doing. We're going to compare you to somebody else. I mean, clearly that was part of the idea. But you have to have a longer time frame than we had to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Now, NIDA has it for research. It can say some programs are better for others, but who's in charge of saying, so what are you going to do about that?
Yeah.
And that should have been OTI's mission, and you try to make it that mission, but it's not always easy to follow through, because even closing down a program that has failed to see a patient is difficult. Mm-hmm. Because you bring in the money, they have people, the people have a representative, the people could vote, they have families, and so they say, but we would have seen people, but we had a problem with the lease, so we couldn't get started. But they managed to put everybody on the payroll and spend the government's, but we couldn't really see any patients because we couldn't get clearance to do this, to do that. I mean, people have a variety of reasons why they couldn't possibly help anybody. Mm-hmm. Except themselves. And you try to close that program, and you have real problems on your hands.
I assume there were also problems with sort of jurisdiction. I mean, the states, like, you know, OASIS in New York, right, seems to, I mean, what's the relationship between CSAT and the state agencies?
Well, you know, Benny's view was that the cities were not getting a fair shake from the states. Mm-hmm. And that's why he called it Target Cities. He wanted to bypass that. This wasn't a decision I made, but that was his view. And so he had things like special populations and things of this sort. He wanted to direct the money where he wanted to direct the money. And the job of his staff was to see that something decent happened with what they did and to figure out a way to evaluate it.
Have you run into these blending initiatives? NIDA has these blending initiatives now to try to talk more directly to treatment providers. For a while in the 90s, there was a perceived split between treatment and research.
Well, they have this, what is it, network, do they call it clinical trials network.
Yeah, there are various structural ways to overcome that problem. There were, for a while, the practice research networks. There are ATCs.
You know, NIDA was perceived as using its, for whatever reason, using its money more wisely or more in keeping with what I guess it was the general liked, McCaffrey, at the time. And they would get more and more budgets, and CSET's budgets would be flat. I think that had more to do with making the case of what you were doing with your money. Mm-hmm. And then NIDA had more money than it could really sink into research, and they came up with this wonderful idea to link the researchers with the treatment. It's hard to say the impact of that. I mean, I'm not on top of the data stream, so I really don't know what's been accomplished. But yeah, there is that. And, you know, the idea, I guess I would feel warmer about it if I could really be certain that the research findings were robust enough to say, this is, if you would do this, you'll get a better outcome. I think it's more nuanced than that. I think that what makes for a good outcome is not just following a rigid procedure that came out of research. I can't tell you exactly what it is. But we're far from kind of, you know, follow the dots and you'll come out a pretty picture. It's not paint by the numbers. But, you know, it's probably better than doing nothing and just letting clinicians do whatever,
they do.
Mm-hmm. But clearly, you know, our view of it is that, you know, there is natural variability, and if you can look at differences in outcome, you can then use the natural variability to say to somebody, if they can get this level of achievement, you should be able to, what do you want to do about it? Mm-hmm. And then at some point, you have to put in the incentives that say, if they get that level of ability, we should give them more. If you get this level of ability, maybe we won't give you a bonus. Mm-hmm. That should provide, you know, you reward results. And that's one way to get people to pay attention, not just to the mechanics of letting people in and doing some things, but
right.
How do we get a good outcome?
Yeah, and there now seems to be quite a bit of emphasis on getting them to treatment providers to adopt evidence-based practices.
That's probably useful, but as I said, even people using evidence-based practices don't get the same outcomes. So there's maybe more to it.
Mm-hmm.
And you still want to look at the outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can look at, you know, everybody using methadone in the methadone program, they're more uniform than others, and you still see significant differences among those programs. What are those differences? What do they do to it? It's not all just patient selection. And now how do you bring them up, all up to the highest quality you can? And I'm not sure how, you know, it's an issue, it's an iterative issue of finding what works best and trying to sort of adopt those practices.
Mm-hmm. Kind of trial and error.
Well, it's always, it's not, I wouldn't quite say trial and error so much as sort of naturally finding, you know, it may be trial and error at any given program, you know. Let's stop hollering at the patients and be a little different. And some good things happen. Yeah, did you want to?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but Dee said this call came for you from Able Film.
Unless you have any more thoughts on the sort of science policy interface that we're beginning to talk to. In other words, are we any closer to not only knowing what works best for whom, but then being able to do something about that knowledge than we were when you know, were.
I think we are. Some states are actually implementing this reward results. They're actually, and I'm surprised it's taken people 30 years, because we were doing it in Illinois, you know, in 1968. I was looking at the opiate positives in different clinics trying to understand. Know why. Some people didn't want to raise it. I mean, there were dosage issues, there were throwing people out issues, there was, you know. The idea of doing this in drug abuse programs where you really say, look, we're going to get urine specimens, we're going to look at whether people stop using drugs, we're going to look at arrest rates, we're going to look at this, we're going to look at that, and this is what we expect. If you can meet that, we're going to give you a 5% bonus. And if you can't, we won't. Now, the net effect of that is, at some point, as you give people a 5% bonus, they're going to do even better. And then you can raise the standard. And the people who don't start to come up to it or find out or have the initiative to find out how they can do better ultimately have to decide to opt out. It'll probably take a long time. The nature of professional practice is such that almost nobody wants to be held accountable. Nobody's ever suggested that you ought to post the results of a lawyer's activity, right? Have you ever heard of that?
No.
What is the conviction rate, or the acquittal rate? You can't find that out.
Even in higher education now, they're saying we should measure outcomes in higher ed, that we now measure K-12.
Yeah.
We're very resistant to that.
Well, we want feedback, we want this. Of course, nobody wants to know how, what do you want to know? The grades of my students, they all get A's. because it's great inflation. I can't give them any more than that. If I give them less, they complain.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I mean, I got into lots of trouble, by the way, with that. Because, you know, I naively went into government, particularly the ARC, and they have this standard of satisfactory, above average, outstanding. And, you know, I thought, we're all satisfactory here. Nobody has won a Nobel Prize. And so I marked everybody satisfactory, which in the scale of things means they all ought to be fired. I marked myself satisfactory. I mean, there's certain accepted hypocritical sets of inflated standards, and you have to understand that this special language, like in the military, fully satisfactory is fire the son of a bitch.
Really?
Outstanding means he, you know, we could promote this guy. But fully satisfactory means, you know, he's not going anyplace.
but
you have to learn that. I didn't know that, and there were people who didn't enlighten me much on it either. So I made a lot of enemies, I guess, for a while.
So when you look at back at the trajectory of your government jobs, are you pleased with the direction that drug policy has come in the last 30 years?
That's a good question. Do we have more treatment? The answer is yes. You know, is it more balanced than it was in, you know, under Anslinger, where you threw people out of your emergency room, you never treated anybody, the doctors didn't know anything about addiction, they didn't know anything, they thought, you know, drug addicts were scum, you know, where alcoholics couldn't be admitted. You know, has that changed? Absolutely. You know, people can say, I was an addict, I recovered. There are lots of people, prominent people, are no longer ashamed to say, I recovered, I'm better. I mean, the stigma of having had an episode of drug problems has been substantially attenuated. And that's probably, you know, it'll be for somebody else's lifetime to take the next step. But I mean, that is a, you know, that is something that I played some role in that, I guess. Getting treatment out so people meet people and see that they do recover. The whole idea of this is recoverable. Yeah. This was the objective, is to say that this is not a permanent relapsing brain disease, although that people take what I said in that first chapter out of context. Addiction is a chronic relapsing brain disorder. Have you heard that?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that definition.
That's not what I said.
What did you say?
I said that basically the loss of flexibility with respect to a drug exists on a continuum. And at one extreme, you know, you have addiction, you have compulsive drug-using disorder, which begins to resemble a chronic relapsing disorder, at one extreme. I never said it is, because it begins. They're milder forms that aren't chronic. People recover.
Yes. And you also didn't say brain disorder. You said chronic relapsing disorder.
Griffith and I have fought this issue of brain disorder now since somebody decided that this is the current mantra. You know, a brain disorder is something that in any environment manifests itself, it seems to me. If you have Alzheimer's, you know, no matter where you are, you can't remember.
No. I really want to hear the chronic brain relapsing brain disorder stuff.
But the model that we have is it's a complex interplay between environment and what may very well be a long-lasting sense of, you know, greater sensitivity to drug-related stimuli. I don't know how long that lasts. There are people who, if they quit smoking, you know, they say, I wanted a cigarette every time I see somebody lighting up. But you ask them, if you don't see somebody lighting up, how much do you want a cigarette? Well, I didn't know that. There may be long-lasting effects There may even be effects that if you start to use, you find yourself unable to stop. But in an environment where you don't start again, it's a disorder that has no known disabilities. Mm-hmm. It's a funny kind of brain disease that doesn't impair you in any way except when you start using drugs, and then maybe it's harder for you than somebody else to stop. So the idea of it's a brain disease means if you could just fix that disease, just fix that part of the brain, there'd be no problem.
So why do you think the definition was taken up? Why did it become the mantra that it did?
I think that it was a useful way for particular agencies to convince funders to raise the budgets so they could fund people doing research in an interesting area.
And do you mean specifically NIDA under Leshner?
Whoever came up with the idea it's a brain disease. It was very successful. The budget has grown. From that perspective, you can't argue with success. But the price, I think, that one pays, it's like a Faustian bargain. It's that you don't see all the other, you minimize all the other major factors that interact. I mean, I just know too many people in complete recovery that for me to view this as they have a permanent brain disease.
Yeah.
You know, I know that people who've been alcoholic probably shouldn't drink again. That they may have a vulnerability, but I'm not sure that that was a vulnerability that was induced by the drug. It may have been that they had some vulnerability that they took with them from, you know, that they had when they were even children. They just didn't get around to showing it. So, you know, there are lots and lots of complexities here that I think are glossed over and minimized when you say it's a brain disease. And I think it's wrong to label every case of drug disorder as a chronic relapsing disorder. You know, it doesn't characterize everybody. One can have relapse, but not everybody does. So to say, you know, it's like describing anything in some truncated, simplistic way. You really distort what it is. And I think you do the people who have had these episodes in some way a disservice. I don't want to, you know, if an employer, I don't want to hire somebody who I know has a chronic relapsing disorder if I can help it. I don't know that I'd want to hire somebody if I were an employer and had to bear all the costs and the law didn't prevent me from doing so. I wouldn't hire somebody with chronic relapsing multiple sclerosis. Not because I don't wish them well, but because the cost of their care would raise the cost of my health care benefits to all the other people to the point where I might not be able to be competitive. Maybe the law requires me to hire them, and I would have to. But clearly, if you define something as this is going to be a big problem, it's a chronic relapsing disorder, you mischaracterize people who've had an episode once in their lives and it's over. You know, people meet the criteria for alcoholism. A very substantial number of young men in their 20s meet those criteria. And, you know, they go on and they do well. Mm-hmm. Many people have stopped smoking, and yet, by that definition, they had an addiction. It's a chronic relapsing disorder. How come if you quit at age 30, you're still 60 and you haven't relapsed? How come? I mean, your concepts have to fit the observations and the facts. And just like habituation and addiction didn't fit, it's more complex. This doesn't fit either.
The phrase itself, was it, did you come up with it? Was it in the air? I mean, how did
Which
you...
Which one?
Chronic relapsing disorder, as you used it in the Goodman and Gilman chapter.
Well, let me get it for you and you decide.
The third edition, your first edition, and you say, in extreme forms, the behavior exhibits the characteristics of a chronic relapsing disease.
Yes. In extreme forms.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that all...
Right. And it's almost as if now the uptake of that definition... I mean, I was going to ask you whether you had thought that that redefinition had been good for science, had it been good for people who are trying to talk to the public, had it been good for clinical practice, right, that this definition gets adopted because it is the extreme form you're talking about here, not the usual form or the less extreme form.
Well, I didn't know how often if you did a population survey. I mean, the people who wind up going to Lexington would probably have the extreme form.
Mm-hmm.
Why would anybody do that if it wasn't extreme?
Right.
But
right.
I can give you the stuff from Lee Robbins' study, and you will see that, in fact, if you had done a population survey, and they've since done those, that what we see coming into treatment is the extreme form.
Yes.
It's not the,
not
thing.
The rest.
I only intuited that at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But this was number four. Here.
Is it there?
The intensity of this dependence may vary from a mild desire to a craving or a compulsion. All right? They may give rise to behavior characterized by preoccupation with the use and procurement of the drug. In extreme forms, it exhibits the behavior of a chronic relapsing disease. Now, you can check in the next one whether it was bothered to change. But if you look, if you understand what Lee found when she looked at everybody, you found that most people...
Again, same sentence. In extreme forms, the behavior exhibits the characteristics of a chronic relapsing disease. So you... never intended it to be used in the way that it is now used.
I intended it to be used in extreme form. But the point is that dependence exists even in those milder forms that don't relapse.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to account for those people who, despite everything, relapse over and over again.
Yes.
I mean, everybody did that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So now you think it's sort of gone too far in the direction of brain disease and irreversibility, because part of my assumption is that the adoption of chronic relapsing brain disorder, the implication that it is not reversible, that there's something permanent about it, is part of the problem.
That's both counterintuitive and counter to all observations.
Mm-hmm.
There are just many too many people, you know, an episode of dependence at some times in their lives, and, you know, they go for the next 50 years of their lives and never have another problem. So, you know, it just doesn't make sense. And particularly if you believe tobacco is part of that, how do you account for the people who quit when they're 25 and don't relapse?
Mm-hmm.
Again, ever.
Yeah. All right, so...
That explains kind of what I said, and why I do think that they've kind of twisted it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
What the motivation was, whether it was just simply sloppy thinking or, you know, a willingness to oversimplify for purpose of a slogan, I don't know.
Yeah. So was there anything that I should have asked you and I didn't?
Who knows? I don't know what you're going to do with it.
Well, hopefully it's not just me, but... I do thank you very much for giving so generously of your time.
You're welcome.
Had a